Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
These huge numbers of rejected ballots are occurring predominantly in rural Alaska, huge Native populations, and in low-income areas.
Ballots rejected in the special election came most frequently from rural Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 16th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, fire evacuees in Bethel prepare to return home to their villages.
It's burning all of our berry spots. I don't know what we're going to do for berries this year.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University offers degree programs with life-friendly, flexible scheduling and course delivery options grounded in real-life experience. Alaska Pacific University offers innovative programming in nursing, counseling, psychology, outdoor and environmental public health, and more. Financial aid is available. Advance your career with APU today. Learn more and apply now at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Some Alaska lawmakers are raising red flags about the number of ballots rejected in the special U.S. House primary election. Ballots are still being tallied, but so far, about 4% of the roughly 155,000 ballots received statewide have been rejected. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, that percentage is much higher in rural Alaska communities.
Alaska just held its first statewide mail-in election. In the crowded primary to fill the rest of Congressman Don Young's term, the top 4 vote-getters are Sarah Palin, Nick Begich, Al Gross, and Mary Peltola. But Anchorage Senator Bill Wilikowski says as votes were tallied in recent days, he was more struck by the number of ballots the state rejected.
These huge numbers of rejected ballots are occurring predominantly in rural Alaska, huge Native populations, and in low-income areas of Alaska.
About 6,200 ballots have been rejected so far by the Division of Elections, coming to just under 4% of all ballots. That's double the rejection rate from the 2020 primary. In the most recent results, the rejection percentage varies starkly by region. In areas near Bethel, it's the highest at around 17%. That means about 1 in every 6 ballots were rejected, and the votes not counted. The rejection rate is above 10% in the Kotzebue and Utqiagvik area, as well as around Nome and Bristol Bay. Along with 5 other Alaska Senate Democrats, Wilikowski sent a letter to Division of Elections officials on Tuesday asking for an explanation for what they described as a, quote, breakdown of our election system and the democratic process for those citizens whose votes were not counted.
It's really imperative for Division of Elections to get a handle on this, figure out what the problem is, and either figure out a way to educate the voters or remove these unnecessary bureaucratic barriers that are being placed that are making it difficult for low-income and Native voters to vote.
Division of Elections officials say they'll have data on why the ballots were rejected after the election is certified on June 25th. They declined to comment on the senator's letter. Wilikowski says he hasn't gotten answers yet from the division either, but he thinks the issue is likely the witness signature requirement on the ballots. The requirement was in place for the 2020 statewide election for absentee ballots, but a Superior Court ruled that was unconstitutional. Wilikowski describes the witness signature requirement for this election as a, quote, bureaucratic roadblock.
You have a signature requirement, but the Division of Elections has no way to verify the signatures. Then you have a witness requirement, but the Division of Elections doesn't verify the signatures of the witness and doesn't even verify that the witness lives in Alaska or is even a living person.
Wilikowski says one potential solution to this problem is through a process called ballot curing. In 24 states, officials will notify residents if there's an issue with their ballot and allow them to make any needed changes before counting it. Currently in Alaska, the state will notify somebody by mail if their ballot is rejected 10 days after the election is certified.
That's something I think the Division of Elections needs to look into. I know in the legislature, we had legislation to allow ballot cure. Unfortunately, it didn't pass. But I'm curious if the Division of Elections has the emergency regulatory authority to just enact that on its own. We're talking about a fundamental right. One of the most fundamental rights that any person has in a democracy is the right to vote.
Historically, elections in Alaska can be close, with Representative Bryce Edgman's election in 2006 being decided by a coin toss, and Representative Bart Laban winning his election by one vote in 2018, a matter that reached the Alaska Supreme Court. Wilikowski says that history also underscores the need to ensure that every Alaska ballot is counted. With three more statewide elections set to happen this year, Wilikowski says if the Division of Elections can't address the issue, a special session of the legislature may be required. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Some evacuees from the East Fork Tundra fire burning near St. Mary's on the Yukon River started to return home today. The rate of the fire spread has slowed over the past few days and is less of a direct danger to communities. But a smoke advisory remains in effect for the area through at least Saturday. Fire officials are warning that fire activity could again worsen if weather patterns change after the weekend. People are flying home despite a smoke advisory and fires still burning close to their villages. The East Fork fire is burning about 3.5 miles away from the community of St. Mary's, 5 miles from Pitka's Point, 7 miles from Pilot Station, and 24 miles from Mountain Village. About 150 people from these villages voluntarily evacuated last week. These were mainly vulnerable residents, including elders, young children, and people with health conditions. Now, about half of them are flying home. And two of the villages they're returning to, St. Mary's and Pitka's Point, remain under a warning urging residents to have essential belongings packed in case of an evacuation. The fire is creating smoky conditions across the region, according to Mark Smith, a state meteorologist. Smith has issued a smoke advisory for southwest Alaska until at least Saturday. Smith says the smoke is most dangerous for those closest to the fire.
A person that is right within the fire is going to have greater impact to health than a person that's, say, in Juneau that's getting hazy conditions from the smoke from your fires there in the southwest.
Smith says potential rain and cool temperatures over the weekend could help extinguish parts of the fire, but sunny weather afterwards could restart it. He said we could know a lot more about the fire and the smoke's potential trajectory after the weekend's rain clears. So, people who fled to Bethel to escape the historic tundra fires along the lower Yukon River have started to return home, and after their week in Bethel, the fire growth has shifted away from communities. But as Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports, returning residents still face a lot of uncertainty, both short-term and long-term.
At the airline terminal for Ute Commuter Services in Bethel, a man plays the harmonica as two kids dance nearby. There's about 20 people waiting. Children squirm in their chairs or spin basketballs, while some of the grown-ups talk on their phones. They're waiting for their names to be called for a seat on a flight back to their homes in St. Mary's, a community of about 600 people on the Yukon River.
St. Mary's, Kara and Corbin.
Elder Sebastian Cowboy is one of the people waiting. He's thankful the town of Bethel took the evacuees in. About 100 people stayed at the two shelters in town after they evacuated due to smoke from a massive tundra fire that burned to within a few miles of the community. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation says there is still a risk of smoke or fire in St. Mary's, and it doesn't have the resources to pay for another flight out should conditions get worse. But Cowboy says he's ready to go home. The thing he misses most?
My own pillow.
Cowboy says he'll get to work on some house projects and chop wood for the winter. Like many other St. Mary's residents, he's feeling a lot of uncertainty about the future. There's the short-term risk of winds shifting smoke back towards the village, but there's also the long-term risks of a warming climate that scientists say is contributing to the unprecedented fires in the region that have so far burned up hundreds of thousands of acres. It's not just the elders who are noticing the changes. Teenager Carmen Tinker says she's noticing things too.
Getting windier in the spring. My epic teacher said that it used to never be windy. In the spring, it got more windy.
Some residents say the north winds that pushed the fire towards their community was unusual for the village that's often cooled by the coastal western breeze. Maureen Andrews, who's stayed at a Bethel shelter with three kids, says a warmer climate means the vegetation around St. Mary's is changing too.
The trees around my home, I notice they have gotten thicker every year.
Those bigger trees mean more fuel for fires to burn. Aside from the health effects of the smoke, some residents are concerned about changes to their food security. Last year, salmon fishing remained closed and has stayed closed through this summer. Evacuating for fires now means less time for other subsistence work, And the fire itself disrupts harvesting, says Roseanne Joe.
It's burning all of our berry spots. I don't know what we're going to do for berries this year. Jeez, no fish, no berries.
Joe says most years she goes up in the hills of the area that's now burning. She says she picks 15 gallons of salmon berries, known in other parts of the state as cloudberries, and 25 gallons of blueberries each year.
Scary to be thinking what my kids are going to grow up to see.
For now, residents of the region say they're taking each day as it comes. There's no playbook for how to adapt to the changing climate. It means that everyone's deciding for themselves whether to stay in Bethel until the fires die down completely or to return home, where the smoke could thicken at any moment. For George Moses, his damaged lungs mean he'll stay in Bethel till it's all cleared.
I gotta wait till it's kind of smoke-free.
Nobody really knows how long it might take for that air to clear. Reporting with help from KYUK's Olivia Eberts in Bethel, I'm Lex Trinan.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Mat-Su School Board votes to ban transgender students from girls' sports.
When the officials in this community turn their backs on transgender youth, these incredibly vulnerable children are left with no one in authority to trust.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Annie Wright Schools, located in Tacoma, Washington, offers rich, thoughtful, and internationally recognized programs for students from around the world. A variety of boarding options are available year-round. There's a virtual preview of the school, the faculty, and campus for high school students seeking to explore international baccalaureate academics, arts, and athletics at aw.org/Alaska. This message sponsored by Annie Wright Schools.
The Matanuska Susitna Borough School Board approved an athletic policy last night that prevents transgender girls from competing on girls' sports teams. The board approved the policy in a 6-1 vote, with board member Dwight Probasco voting against it. According to the policy, students' eligibility to play on girls' or boys' sports teams depends on their gender assigned at birth. Transgender girls can only play on boys' teams or co-ed teams. Board members who supported the policy said it protected the rights of women and girls. Member Jubilee Underwood said it would ensure their access to scholarships and other accolades.
This is a safeguard so that women are ensured that they can use the education system and this school district to a path to go beyond, and that nobody else is going to come in and take that from them.
Probasco, the only school board member opposed to the policy, said he thought the district could face legal action because of it.
I believe that this policy, if it is approved, is discriminatory towards our transgender youth. I believe it is a very invasive policy that cuts into the students' rights to privacy. I believe that transgender girls have the same rights as a cisgender girl afforded under Title IX.
The vote followed nearly 2 hours of public testimony from local parents, students, teachers, and community members. More people spoke against the ban than for it, but the testimony was close to evenly split. Speakers who opposed the ban said it could negatively impact students' safety and mental health. Rachel Levitt, a parent in the district, said the policy would send a negative message to transgender children like hers.
When the officials in this community turn their backs on transgender youth, these incredibly vulnerable children are left with no one in authority to trust.
Opponents said the policy would exclude transgender students from participating in activities they enjoy. Carrie Anderson, another local parent, disagreed.
It's actually exclusion for girls, excluding the next girl on the bench, excluding the next place winner in a competition, excluding the next girl for a scholarship.
Just before the end of the legislative session, state senators voted to table a bill that would have enacted similar restrictions statewide. About a dozen states have passed similar laws. Canceling a planned reading by a drag queen at Ketchikan's public library could be illegal, according to the city's attorney. In a written opinion, attorney Mitch Seaver tells the city council that a proposal to nix the event could open the city to civil rights lawsuits and other penalties. He says it could also run afoul of a local non-discrimination ordinance, state civil rights law, and the U.S. Constitution. The Storytime event scheduled for Friday is one of a few activities the library planned for Pride Month. The library director says the reading, which is open to the public, is an effort to promote inclusivity. But it's been controversial, with some residents calling for the library to cancel the reading and others encouraging the library to go forward with the event as planned. Tonight, a day before the planned story time, Ketchikan City Council is scheduled to consider a proposal from City Council member Riley Gass to cancel the event. The city attorney's 10-page memo comes in response to Gass's proposal. In the memo, Siever ticks through several cases from state and federal courts that outline the constitutional principle that governments aren't allowed to pick and choose which viewpoints are expressed in public spaces. Siever says the proposal to cancel the drag queen story time could also violate a local civil rights ordinance that outlaws discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression. And he says the state civil rights law has also been interpreted by the Alaska Human Rights Commission to outlaw discrimination against LGBTQ people after a 2020 U.S. Supreme Court decision. He says a drag queen reading, quote, would seem to fall within that category. Wrangell's local government has signed off on the purchase of the community's former mill site, a deepwater industrial site out the highway. As KSDK's Sage Smiley reports, local officials say they see the purchase as an opportunity to build Wrangell's economy by encouraging investment.
6 miles down Wrangell's winding coastal highway, the former center of the local economy sits mostly empty, save for a few buildings, scrap metal, and a growth of alders. But Wrangell's officials believe the 39-acre former Wrangell mill site has economic potential. On June 14th, Wrangell's assembly unanimously approved spending $2.5 million to purchase the property. Wrangell's local government has floated a number of ideas for what might be done with the site, ranging from a second community marine haulout center to a possible site for larger ship tourism to a mariculture center. Other former mill sites around Southeast have been redeveloped in a number of ways. Ketchikan's former pulp mill site pivoted from timber to tourism and is now a cruise ship dock. Sitka's former mill site became a deepwater port and industrial park. Local paper The Wrangell Sentinel reports the initial timeline of approving the mill property purchase was delayed by a lien on the property. There was a contract dispute between the property owner and a contractor conducting scrap metal recycling at the site. At the meeting when the assembly approved the purchase, borough manager Jeff Good explained that a deal had been worked out, where part of the money from the purchase will go into a trust, which will be disputed between the contractor and former property owner. Mayor Steve Prasunka clarified.
So basically, the lien amount will be put in a trust separate from the sale.
Correct.
We will get full title to the property, clear of any liens.
Correct.
And then that they'll battle over that trust, and we won't have any involvement in that at all.
Correct.
The mill property purchase has faced some opposition from residents. Wayne Kerr said he disagreed with taking the mill property off city tax rolls, and he'd rather the local government give purchase money back to Wrangell residents.
On this mill property, why don't you take that mill or money instead of buying that mill? Nobody knows what's going on with it yet, except it's probably full of transmission fluid and stuff, maybe dead bodies under it. And take that money and dole it out to people like me. And, you know, I wouldn't mind getting a check for $2,000 every couple of months.
Sure.
Prasunka explained that the borough's intention isn't to hold on to the property. He said they want
to help private enterprise to access the property and be able to utilize that property and to generate commerce out there and to use it in a way that brings economic benefit and to the community. It's one of the last remaining deep water ports in Southeast Alaska. It's highly valuable and it's being underutilized. So there's a huge benefit to us being able to have some site control and help determine what happens there get this thing cooking along and get some stuff happening.
Wrangell's local government made previous attempts to purchase the former mill site starting in the mid-2010s. Borough manager Jeff Good says if all goes according to plan, the borough will close on the property June 20th. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
Alaskan News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com. Parents, did you know that 1 out of 4 Alaska high school students currently use e-cigarettes? E-cigarettes are easy to use and easy to hide. What teens breathe in and out from e-cigarettes is not safe. It contains cancer-causing chemicals, toxic metals, and nicotine. Nicotine can lead to addiction. It can harm brain development and hurt memory, learning, and attention span. Parents, talk to your teens about vaping. Visit livevapefree at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quitline.
Salmon passage on the lower Yukon River is lagging. A sonar counter at Pilot Station had tallied only 2,400 Chinook and 307 summer chum salmon as of Monday. Federal Management biologist Holly Carroll assessed the situation during a weekly Yukon River Fisheries Drainage Association teleconference Tuesday.
Our counts at Pilot Station sonar right now are well below average for both Chinook and summer chum, and so right now it's just really essential that we get all these salmon up to the spawning grounds.
Salmon fishing is being closed in sync with migration upriver.
If we do this now, you know, it should make it that enough fish get to the spawning grounds and we should see better returns in the future. So I just want to thank everyone for that stewardship and that conservation.
This year's Yukon River Chinook and chum runs are forecast to be similar to last year's weak returns and again, insufficient to meet escapement goals and provide any surplus for harvest. Last week, Governor Mike Dunleavy announced nearly 13,000 pounds of salmon would be donated to the Yukon-Kuskokwim region to communities affected by poor salmon returns. There aren't many ways to get from point A to point B on the central Kenai Peninsula without a car. Today, there's one weekday shuttle option through the Central Area Rural Transit System, or CARTS. Otherwise, a taxi cab is the best bet. Now, the Kenaitse Indian Tribe is working on adding another public transport option. It's piloting a fixed-route bus service that will take passengers between Nikiski and Sterling, expected to start in 2023. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
Brandy Bell is the Elders and Transportation Manager for the Kenaitse Indian Tribe. She's been thinking about this project for a long time.
I was raised here, and certainly as a youth and a young person, I saw the need for transportation that long ago. So it's always been, you know, something in the back of my mind. We're so widely spread out that, you know, it makes it very difficult for people to get any to the next town over.
The tribe is piloting the program for tribal members and non-members both, using a $1.1 million federal grant. The grant's geared toward providing more transportation around tribal land in rural areas and will fund a 2-year pilot program.
We hope that this will be a complement to CARTS and to the local cab services, in that we may be able to take people those long hauls and then they continue to take those people to their final destination.
CARTS, which provides the only existing public transportation option on the central Kenai Peninsula, requires appointments in advance and operates on weekdays. Jennifer Beckman from CARTS says the nonprofit hopes to bring back weekend service pending a local match for funding. And she says she hasn't heard specifics about the tribe's busing plan yet, but she says the more options there are for public transportation on the central peninsula, the better, especially if they can complement each other's routes. The tribe does currently have a door-to-door on-demand service for people who receive services from the tribe. It takes riders to errands and doctor's appointments. But Bell says they haven't been able to keep up with the big demand to get members to school and to work.
We started looking at the community as a whole and how transportation affects everyone. In that, you know, you don't have good transportation, you're not making those doctor's appointments, you're not able to have those healthy community connections.
This route will serve the general public, she says, expanding beyond those who receive services from the tribe. Bell says there will be a fee associated with that service.
We have not determined what that fee scale will be, but it will be very affordable because the goal is to connect people with community activities at an affordable price.
She says the new system will travel between Nikiski and Sterling several times a day, making stops on a to-be-determined route. She says the tribe is working with the cities of Kenai and Soldotna and the Kenai Peninsula Borough to work out the best places for those stops, including Fred Meyer, the Kenai Municipal Airport, and Central Peninsula Hospital. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
The Prince of Wales Island community of Thorn Bay finally has a new library. Community members held a grand opening celebration this weekend. The library will act as a source of 24-hour free public internet, host programs and workshops, and of course, be a place for residents to gather and read good books. And as KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, it was a community effort to officially open the doors.
Until 1999, there wasn't a library in Thorn Bay, says Friends of the Library Chair Karen Peterson.
We used to get all of our books and videos and magazines in the mail from the state library out of Juneau.
Thorn Bay's first library was set up in a former Ketchikan Pulp Company office building along the waterfront. Around 2005, the library moved into an old trailer that had previously housed a school in Naugatie. And ever since, it's been a goal of the community to improve the library. Peterson says that libraries used to be funded with state resources, but that's changed.
The state of Alaska, you know, for the last 7 or 8 years has not had a lot of money, and there hasn't been any funding through the state for public libraries.
And so through bake sales and auditions and raffle tickets and campaigns, the community raised $160,000 for a new building. Peterson says they set their eyes on a modular style building with about 30% more space than the current library.
You know, with the old Naugatie school building, one half of the library was the children's area. Reference was in the hallway. The Alaska material was in the bathroom. And in the other room was the adult and adult fiction and computer area. So definitely we increased our space. And it's actually purpose-built space, right? It's built to be a library. So it looks like a library. It feels like a library.
But she says it was hard to find a company willing to take on the task of designing it and getting it to Alaska. That was until January of last year, when Timberland Homes in Auburn, Washington took on the job. But then they saw the quote from Timberland. It came in $100,000 higher than what the community had raised. So Peterson says the Friends of the Library started calling around for more help.
But we called Rasmussen Foundation, and they were really impressed with the amount of money that we had raised so far, and they said they could help us with the difference plus a little bit for shipping.
So in early October, the building was loaded onto a barge and shipped from Washington to Thorn Bay in two pieces. Peterson says it was barged in during a storm. Once it arrived, she says it was a community effort to transfer everything from the old building. Even Thorn Bay's basketball team pitched in to move all the shelves and books in the library's collection. Then, finally, the library was ready to open its doors. On a stormy Saturday, Peterson says some 60 people turned out for the grand opening.
We had folks from Thorn Bay, visitors to the community, and folks from other communities on the island there. So it was great.
The Thorn Bay Library is open for business and staffed by volunteers. Peterson says people can sit and use the free internet connection on the covered porch while the building is closed. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early in Anchorage, Lex Trinan and Olivia Eberts in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Eric Stone and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, Sage Smiley in Wrangell, and Sabine Pooks in Kenai. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.